Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is side two of For the Record program number 445, titled The Bush Family and the Intelligence Community. This is being recorded on February 8th of 2004. WFMU is archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio. More recent programs streaming at www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery. Older programs available for download only at a longer URL linked to both the wfmu.org/Dave Emery website and to the Real Audio equipped For the Record section of the Spitfire website as well. Spitfire is at www.spitfirelist.com, SPITFIRELIST.com. And the For the Record section of the Spitfire website features long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs. The description for the Record 445 will be on in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website within a week or so of the airing of this program. By the way, listeners who would like to support the work that I do can find a section to click on at the beginning of each For the Record description, and that will take them to a page where they can pursue the instructions. Now, we're going to continue with our discussion of some of the historical connections between the Bush family and the intelligence community. We've been accessing information from the recent book American Dynasty, subtitled Aristocracy, Fortune, and the Politics of Deceit in the White House. This is authored by Kevin Phillips, published in hardcover by Viking Press. Copyright 2004 by Kevin Phillips. This is, as I said, a very important book, all the more important because it comes from a person who is not only a mainstream media figure, but actually a conservative, someone who is very supportive of a number of Republican presidents. And this is a book that will ring very familiar to veteran listeners to this program. What we're going to do is to discuss Prescott Bush Sr., and the apparent connections that he had to the intelligence community. As discussed in For the Record Program 445 Side 1, Prescott Bush was one member of the Bush family heavily involved with the Wall Street power elite. Through that elite's connections to Nazi Germany, Prescott Bush was deeply involved with firms like the Silesian American Corporation, Hamburg America Line, and the Thiessen connections of UBC. And this placed Prescott Bush and other members of the Bush family in the transatlantic financial and industrial axis that not only helped to finance the German war effort, but that also figured in a prominent way in the post-World War II and Cold War dealings in particular. I should note that American Dynasty, as one might well guess, does not go into some of the things that I talk about in this context, such as the Bormann Flight Capital Program and the operations of the Underground Reich. That's to be understood because Kevin Phillips doesn't want to be labeled a conspiracy kook a la Dave Emery, so this is not something one should hold against him. Nonetheless, this is a very, very important book. We're going to take a look at the historical connections between the Bush family and the intelligence community, beginning with some of the discussion of Prescott Bush Sr. that was excerpted inside one of this broadcast. By the way, one of the things we're going to note here is that the elder George Bush apparently became involved with the intelligence community well before his official appointment by Gerald Ford to be CIA director. And we're going to take a look, too, at the skull and bones connections to the intelligence community in this particular section of the broadcast. Turning to Kevin Phillips' American Dynasty, speaking of Prescott Bush Sr., which brings us to what, in the television quiz show parlance of that very era, was called the $64,000 question. Who and what was Prescott Bush in the U.S. intelligence community? And did he leave a legacy to his son? Skipping down, speaking after discussing some of the interlocking directorates between that Prescott Bush sat on and interlocking directorates that overlapped the milieu of the CIA, the author then turns to Dresser Industries. Dresser Industries was the first post-World War II employer of the elder George Bush. It is now part of Halliburton Oil, whose former CEO was Dick Cheney, the current vice president. Dresser's CIA connections probably match those of CBS and Pan American Airways. Researcher Bruce Adamson has obtained copies of 1953-54 correspondence between Dresser Chief Neil Mallon and CIA Director Alan Dulles. The meetings arranged between the two men sometimes also included Senator Prescott Bush, ex-German intelligence agent Hans Gasevius, or Defense Secretary Charles Wilson. Several of the letters cited, notably a pilot project in the Caribbean that had been thought up by Gasevius, hardly your everyday Dallas executive, now working for Dresser and Mallon. Henry Neal Mallon was a member of Skull and Bones, by the way, and Gasevius, obviously, one of the many former German intelligence agents who then went to work, at least ostensibly, for the U.S., although, as I've discussed in past broadcasts, they actually had their own agenda, and it is going to prove very much the worse, I think, for the United States that we employed people like this. Continuing. The intrigue researcher, connecting these dots and many others, starts to assume that Prescott Bush of Yale, Skull and Bones, and Brown Brothers Harriman was an off-the-books eminence grise, a man who could be trusted, perhaps even a shadow CIA director. How he might have gotten there is even more murky. There's discussion of the possible entry of Prescott Bush to the intelligence community, this possibly coming during World War I when he served in U.S. military intelligence, quite possibly coming from some of the Anglophile Yalies that Bush moved in whose circles Bush moved in the post-World War I period. Substance of the many areas of investigation offered by Kevin Phillips, the following can be concluded, returning once again to American Dynasty. One conclusion can be reasonably drawn, that the men who managed most of the high-level financial and corporate relations between the United States and Nazi Germany in the period from 1933 to 1941 developed an unusual kind of information and expertise that made them important to the war effort in general and the U.S. intelligence community in particular. As a result, after World War II was over, with the Soviet Union soon becoming an enemy and Germany being transformed into a U.S. ally, the new American national security state formed around a new establishment in which Prescott Bush and many of his friends were prominent and honored members. Skipping ahead, we're going to take a look at some of the elder George Bush's probable entrees into the intelligence community. And in particular, we're going to take a look at George H. Walker and George H. Walker Jr., his son. George H. Walker is the great-grandfather of the current seated president, the grandfather of George Sr. And we're going to take a look at their extensive, the Walker family's extensive holdings in the Caribbean, in Cuba in particular. We're also going to revisit the Caribbean dealings of Dresser Industries. And remember, that is the largest oil field drilling firm in the world and the first employer of the elder George Bush. It also was an employer of Hans Gasevius, former German intelligence agent and associate of Alan Dulles, who was working for Dresser at this point and suggested the Caribbean project. Of the Walker family's Cuban investments and the role that may have played in the entree of the elder George Bush into the intelligence community, we read, "The influences of Prescott Bush's milieu must have been significant, but we should not forget George H. Walker's role. We've explored Prescott Bush's own circle and its wide connections. As for Walker, no one can know what in those summer walks and hours out on the old man's boat in the 1930s and 1940s he told the grandson who carried his name." Parenthetically, that's the elder George Bush. Continuing. "However, Walker had derring do to spare, plus strong interest in the Caribbean, where the political and covert action was soon to heat up. In addition to his European ventures, he had long-standing ties to Cuba and served as a director of seven related companies during the mid and late 1920s and early 1930s. The Cuba Company, the Cuban Railroad, Cuban Dominican Sugar, Barahona Sugar, Cuba Distilling, Sugar Estates of Oriente, and Atlantic Fruit and Sugar. Prominent New York investment bankers did not undertake such commitments lightly. Walker was centrally involved with the island through three major industries, sugar, rum distilling, and a major railroad that served these enterprises and became a symbol of Yankee power. In the 1930s and early 1940s, young Bush's favorite uncle, Herbie, George Herbert Walker, Jr., took over directorships of several of these Cuban-Dominican sugar companies, which ultimately merged into West Indies Sugar in 1942. It's not hard to imagine the young George H.W. Bush picking up from grandfather and uncle alike a romantic, sugar plantation, rum and palm trees image of the heavily policed old regime Cuba of Fulgencio Batista. The island was very much liked by a visiting generation of middle and upper class Americans. His uncle would have been angry in 1959 when the new leftist Castro regime announced that it would nationalize the holdings of the U.S. sugar companies. Castro had launched his revolution several years earlier in eastern Cuba's sugar and rum-centered Oriente province, and some of the American owners of sugar mills and estates had contributed funds in hopes of moderating his movement. Oriente-based West Indies sugar had been a particular target of rebel levies and depredations. Coincidentally, 1959 was the year when Uncle Herbie helped to finance the reorganization of Zapata Oil, by which the offshore drilling rigs, at least one operating near Cuba, became independent under Walker Bush control. George H. Walker Jr. must have been even angrier in 1960 when Castro nationalized the West Indies Sugar Company, of which he had been a director until 1959. Infuriated by Castro's sugar estate seizures, the U.S. government withdrew its recognition of Cuba and launched an economic embargo in January of 1961. 3 months later came the Bay of Pigs invasion. Grandfather Walker had died in 1953, but Prescott Bush, too, had a considerable psychological involvement with Cuba, its politics, and its importance to the United States. The events of both the late 1950s and early 1960s would make the commitments of both Prescott and George H.W. Bush stand out in bold relief. Cuba's fate would be a personal as well as professional preoccupation. Old Batista-era loyalties would linger even into the 21st century when Florida Governor Jeb Bush would nominate Batista's grandson, Raul Cantero, to the state Supreme Court. George H.W. Bush's intelligence connections may have affected when and why he went to Texas. Working for Ray Kravis in Tulsa might not have been relevant. Working for Neil Mallon as Dresser shifted its focus and headquarters from Ohio to Texas and turned global would have been more so. Dresser had top secret clearances during the 1941-45 war years for various projects, and after Mallon relocated to Dallas in 1950, the company's greatest growth came from overseas activity, conceivably including some covert projects. The international side of the oil business, whether in the Middle East or the Caribbean, lent itself to close involvement with the CIA and U.S. intelligence, as numerous chroniclers have elaborated. Although George Bush left Dresser in 1951, he maintained close relations with Mallon and with other friends there. They referred clients to him after he joined up with the Liedtke brothers in 1953 to form Zapata Petroleum, which decided to branch out into deep-sea drilling with Zapata offshore in 1954. This happened to be the year when the CIA under Alan Dulles stepped up its own Caribbean activity with the overthrow of the left-leaning government of Jacobo Arbenz Guzman in Guatemala. Bruce Adamson, who assembled the Dresser-Dulles correspondence, wondered about a possible connection between the Bush-Liedtke-Zapata offshore enterprise and the Caribbean project that Dresser Chief Mallon and former German intelligence officer Hans Gasivius had discussed a little earlier with Dulles. Here, analysis has to rely on implication and common sense. Adamson, Loftus, The Nation magazine, and the U.S. journalism effort named Project Censored all posited some direct George H.W. Bush CIA connection emerging between 1954 and 1963. Related hints of a Mexican-connected Bush initiation also came from reporter Jonathan Quitney in his 1988 Barron's article, The Mexican Connection. The implications are considerable. Concrete proof is minimal. In 1988, during Bush's presidential campaign, Quitney revealed that back in 1960, Bush and Zapata offshore, together with Jorge Diaz Serrano, a Mexican oil man recommended by Dresser, had set up a new Mexican company called Permargo. The latter, under the authority of Pemex, the Mexican oil monopoly, was to do deep-sea drilling off the Mexican coast for Pan American Petroleum, a firm run by U.S. oil man Ed Pauley. Pemex and Pauley were both known for CIA connections. Bush, however, was already drilling for Pauley under a Zapata offshore contract. Deals about Zapata's Permargo involvement didn't check out, and Quitney smelled a rat or two, especially when it emerged that in 1981, shortly after Bush had been elected vice president, the SEC, quote, inadvertently destroyed, unquote, the Zapata offshore SEC filings for 1960 to 1966. Some years later, Loftus wrote, the old spies say Bush lost his virginity in the oil business to Ed Pauley, unquote. He added that, quote, the Zapata-Permargo deal also caught the attention of Alan Dulles, who the old spies report was the man who recruited Bush's company as a part-time purchasing agent for the CIA. Zapata provided commercial supplies for one of Dulles's most notorious operations, the Bay of Pigs invasion. Biographers have found more Zapata details in the papers of former U.S. Senator Ralph Yarborough, whom Bush unsuccessfully opposed in the 1964 election. That year, Yarborough, who liked to call Bush a Connecticut carpetbagger, had arranged for a supporter named Alan Mandel to do some campaign research on Bush's company. What Mandel turned up, his report still exists among the senator's papers in Austin, was a description of Zapata Offshore's unusual and complex business structure. A half dozen subsidiaries ranging from Zapata International, Seacat Zapata, and Zapata de Mexico to the Zapata Overseas Corporation. Tax advantages were one explanation. Handling covert funds could have been another. As for CIA ties, Permargo obviously had some. In addition, note has been made of the published correspondence that connected Dresser with the CIA and Alan Dulles. We will also shortly see that the Liedtkes and Zapata-turned-Pennzoil were tied with Pemex to a 1972 CIA money laundering chain related to the Watergate break-in. Bruce Adamson added that, quote, George Bush and Edwin Pauley, both CIA, were listed in 1954 and 55 in CIA asset George de Morenchild's personal address book, which I obtained a copy of from the West Palm Beach Sheriff's Office in 1992. By the way, George de Morenchild, a white Russian, former German spy, according to many reports, was one of Lee Harvey Oswald's intelligence handlers. Next, we're going to take a look at the role of the Skull and Bones in the Bay of Pigs-related dealings, and we're also going to take a look at the evolution of this slush fund and its role in the Watergate scandal. Recall in some of the work that I did with Harry Martin of the Napa Sentinel, one of the alleged operatives in the October surprise had channeled money from some of this slush fund still left in Mexican banks. This individual died under strange circumstances shortly afterward. Turning to Skull and Bones in the Bay of Pigs, Yale man Ron Rosenbaum, who wrote about Skull and Bones in the New York Observer and elsewhere, came up with a chilling angle in his attempts to trace the Shell Corporation, the Russell Trust Association, that had funded the Society's year-to-year existence. A check with the Connecticut Secretary of State's office in 2000 found no such corporation, which seemed to leave a dead end. But then a researcher's careful follow-up found out that years earlier, the association had been abolished, then reestablished under the name RTA Incorporated. Let Rosenbaum tell his own tale of discovery. The new papers of reincorporation that erased the century-old Russell Trust Association were filed at 10:15 a.m. on April 14, 1961. 2 hours later, at noon on that day, the orders went out to begin the Bay of Pigs operations, the covert CIA-financed invasion of Castro's Cuba, a bloody fiasco that still haunts us four decades later. Coincidence? Probably. But then it's also true that one of the CIA's masterminds for the Bay of Pigs operation was a man named Richard Drain, Skull and Bones 43. And the White House planner of the Bay of Pigs operation was McGeorge Bundy, Skull and Bones 40. And the State Department liaison for the Bay of Pigs operation was his brother William P. Bundy, Skull and Bones 39. And the man who filed the reincorporation papers that erased the Russell Trust Association from existence on the day of the Bay of Pigs was Howard Weaver, Skull and Bones 45, George Bush's class, who retired from the CIA in 1959. All of which might lead one to suspect that the Skull and Bones corporate shell had been used as a clandestine conduit for the Bay of Pigs and then erased from existence to cover up the connection as the invasion got underway. Yes, it must be a coincidence. It has to be a coincidence. It's fair to say that by December of 1975, when White House Chief of Staff Donald Rumsfeld, today, of course, Secretary of Defense, was working to derail George H.W. Bush's presidential ambitions by slotting him as CIA director, three generations of the Bush and Walker families already had some six decades of intelligence-related activity and experience under their belts. However, there is still one more connection to mention. The Pemex Pennzoil CIA money line, coincidentally or otherwise, exposed in 1972 after funds it provided through Mexican banks were found in the hands of the Watergate burglars. Of those men, a solid majority, Howard Hunt, Frank Sturgis, Eugenio Martinez, Virgilio Gonzalez, and Bernard Barker, had been involved in the abortive Bay of Pigs episode. Nixon and his senior advisors knew that the money had come through Mexican banks from the Texans, unquote, Regional Nixon Finance Chief William Liedtke, Robert Mosbacher, and other Bush friends. Apparently, they were not sure what that meant, what kind of a CIA pipeline was involved, or what kind of usage was underway. Author Lofta says that George H.W. Bush's subsequent high standing with the intelligence community came not from his Bay of Pigs involvement, but from, quote, when he told Nixon that he could not shift the blame for the Mexican slush fund to the CIA without wrecking the intelligence community, unquote. There is no proof that Bush conveyed any such warning. Moreover, Nixon's White House Chief of Staff, H.R. Haldeman, gave a different view in his 1978 book, The Ends of Power. If the Mexican bank connection was actually a CIA operation all along, unknown to Nixon, and Nixon was destroyed for asking the FBI to stop investigating the bank because it might uncover a CIA operation, which the Helms memo seems to indicate it actually was all along, the multiple layers of deception by the CIA are astounding. At any rate, the national security state was only slightly wounded in the 60s and 70s, rebounding to thrive in the 80s and 90s despite a few bumps after the breakup of the Soviet Union, when the CIA briefly feared for its future. More to the point, two men named George Bush would be CIA director, vice president, or president of the United States for 17 of the 28 years between 1976 and 2004. In a very real but little understood sense, the Bush dynasty was already getting underway in 1980-81 when George Bush went from the CIA director's job to the vice presidency, a job no one had ever managed before, and one that brought a new and unfamiliar mindset to the elected executive office. In 1981, because of Bush's CIA experience, and perhaps also because of the influence of the White House Chief of Staff, James A. Baker III, who had managed the Texans' 1980 nomination campaign, President Reagan issued National Security Directive 3, naming the vice president to head a special situation group to identify national security crises and plan for them. A new era of clandestine arms sales, massive armaments buildups, secret diplomacy, and covert actions, perhaps as much Bush's doing as Reagan's, was about to unfold in the Middle East generally, and in Iran, Iraq, and Afghanistan specifically. With it, the seeds of two Persian Gulf wars and hundreds of terrorist strikes would be fertilized and watered. And that appointment by Reagan of Bush, courtesy of that National Security Directive, is discussed at considerable length in FTR program number 248. And those wars were called by Kevin Phillips in the book The Wars of the Texas Succession. Kevin Phillips has an afterword to Dynasty titled Machiavelli and the American Dynastic Movement. I'm going to close the broadcast with a couple of excerpts from that. The political thinker Niccolò Machiavelli, 1469 to 1527, long a believer in the famous Florentine Republic of the Renaissance, began to lose his faith in later years as the tides of imperial power and ambition, French, German, and Spanish, swept across the Italian peninsula, washing away the old republican politics of city-states like Florence and Siena, too small to survive on their own. Unlike Machiavelli's less well-known books, which embraced republican politics and institutions, his most famous volume, The Prince, was dedicated to Lorenzo de' Medici, the Duke of Urbino. It encapsulated the techniques, from amorality and fraud to religion, by which the ascendant princely rulers might govern most successfully. As the 2004 presidential election took shape, another such Machiavellian movement was at hand. U.S. President George W. Bush, while hardly a Medici, was a dynast whose family heritage included secrecy and calculated deception. Hearkening to the increasingly imperial self-perception of the United States, the president's theorists and tacticians boasted of taking the advice of Machiavelli and the Chinese strategist Sun Tzu. The late Lee Atwater, chief political advisor to the elder Bush and Karl Rove, strategist for the younger Bush friends and collaborators, were both devotees of Machiavelli and the prince. Hardly a coincidence. And still more from the afterword. The possibility that the United States could edge toward its own Machiavellian moment in an early 21st century milieu of terrorism, neo-imperialism, and dynastization is not far-fetched. As we have seen, Rove, the Bush dynasty's own political plotter, has been an avid reader of Machiavelli. While the analysis in The Discourses upholds republicanism, the advice Machiavelli gives in The Prince was dedicated to the Medicis and designed to work in the new princely, aristocratic, and neo-imperial milieu of 16th century Italy. Chapter 4, in its discussion of Bush domestic policy and compassionate conservative rhetoric, has already referred to Machiavelli's advice that the prince should lie, but must, quote, be able to disguise this character well and to be a great feigner and dissembler, unquote. Moreover, quote, to see and hear him, he, the prince, should seem to be all mercy, faith, integrity, humanity, and religion. And nothing is more necessary than to seem to have this last quality. Everybody sees what you appear to be, few feel what you are. Other advice dwells on the merits of fraud, hypocrisy, faithlessness, and related practices, and 20th century academicians have noted Machiavelli's appeal to leaders like Hitler, Stalin, and Mussolini. Doubtless, there are also hundreds of copies of The Prince at the CIA, which makes it revealing and arguably ill-advised that the two political advisors to the two presidents Bush should claim it as a Bible of sorts. Even in religion, Machiavelli's advice to emphasize it is relevant to the early 21st century United States. Machiavelli's career in Florence overlapped that of Friar Girolamo Savonarola, the religious despot who ruled the Gasping Republic from 1494 to 1498, with a politics of fighting sin and immorality. Doubtless, the youthful Machiavelli absorbed how close Savonarola came to achieving a theocracy even in Republican Florence. Not a few Americans see a little bit of Savonarola in George W. Bush. The advent of a Machiavelli-inclined dynasty in what may be a Machiavellian moment for the American Republic is not a happy coincidence, but one that demands attention. Luckily, the arrival of a U.S. presidential election every fourth year typically brings with it an uncommon intensity of national debate, so perhaps attention will be paid. Since the events and upheavals of 2000-2001, the United States has had an abundance of unfolding transformations to discuss in economics, national security, and even religion. Of these, many can be considered and managed separately. But one is pervasive enough to make its impact felt almost everywhere, the extent to which national governance has at least temporarily moved away from the proven tradition of a leader chosen democratically by a majority or plurality of the electorate, to the succession of a dynastic heir whose unfortunate inheritance is privileged, covert, and globally embroiling. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record Program number 445, The Bush Family and the Intelligence Community, being recorded on February 8th of 2004. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.